Bring yellow scrap as a leaf. When I did, everything changed. I raised my head. My breath caught. Wonder poured through me, brighter than a sunrise spilling over the horizon, headier than a glass of sparkling champagne. We were in the autumn lands. Dim as it was, the forest glowed. The golden leaves flashing by blazed like sparks caught in the updraft of a fire. A scarlet carpet unrolled before us, rich and flawless as velvet. Rising from the forest floor, the black, tangled roots breathed a bluish mist that reduced the farthest trees' trunks to ghostly silhouettes, yet left their foliage's luminous hues untouched. Vivid moss speckled the branches like tarnished copper. The crisp spice of pine sap infused the cool air over a musty perfume of dry leaves. A knot swelled in my throat. I couldn't look away. There was too much of it, too fast. I'd never be able to drink it all in. I needed to absorb every leaf, every chip of bark, every flake of moss. I clenched my fingers in Rook's mane, ravenous for my paintbrush, my easel. Sitting up straighter, I let the wind rush over me and fill my lungs to bursting. It still wasn't enough. After 17 years of living in a world that never changed, I felt as though I'd just flung off a stifling wool sweater and felt the breeze on my skin for the very first time. Nothing would ever be enough again. When his pace slowed, the absence of the wind tearing at my clothes and the sound and motion of his pounding gallop left me strangely bereft. My thoughts whirled, and the blood buzzed in my veins. Every sound seemed muffled after the wild ride. His hooves barely disturbed the cushioned forest floor. Steam gusted from his nostrils in perfect silence. Finally, he lowered himself to his knees in the middle of a glade. I slid off on legs weakened to the point of trembling, and turned in a slow, unsteady circle. No horn sounded in the distance. No baying of hounds disturbed the misty air. No droning grasshoppers here, only the music of crickets, the liquid peeping of frogs, the quiet plop of acorns falling from trees. Not a single raven roosted above me. The danger had passed. Therefore, when I completed my revolution, I froze at the sight of Rook back in his normal form, standing with his sword drawn. And I forgot to think altogether when he turned the blade upon himself. Six. I didn't protest. I didn't scream. Whatever he was doing, I was neither willing nor able to stop him. He didn't look at all weary or disheveled as he knelt with his right sleeve rolled up to the elbow, the sword laid across his hand. A curl of damp hair clinging to his forehead was the only sign that remained from our reckless flight, the sweat that had previously soaked his neck and shoulders. Calmly, he looked aside, and then he drew the blade across his palm in one vicious stroke. Blood spattered the moss below. It was a paler color than human blood, and thicker, as though mixed with tree sap. Once the shock wore off, I understood Rook was working some fairy magic. Whatever it was, I hoped it hurt. Perhaps it would even weaken him in a way I might use to my advantage. "You said there were only two other fair ones as powerful as you," I said, curtsying for his attention. "I thought you meant the regents of the spring and winter courts, but is Hemlock one of them?" He wiped his hand off on the moss, bent over his knee in a seamless bow, and stood. The cut had vanished, though I had no way of knowing whether it was truly healed or merely disguised by his glamour. The latter struck me as something he would do out of pride.
"All of us have different gifts, some more than others. I can change my shape, and as a prince I command the power of my season. Hemlock is known for her prowess in battle, but she is no winter lord. Perhaps, if all my magic were exhausted, or if I chose not to use it, I might meet her in physical combat as an equal."
His lip curled. I wondered how often he wished he could lie. "Her fairy beasts must be a danger to you, then," I ventured, sensing an opportunity to learn more about his weaknesses. if not one or two at a time, the entire pack fighting at her side. He sheathed his sword in a violent motion and strode over to me, stopping only when we almost touched, staring down. I felt his breath on my upturned face. My heart skipped a beat. He was a little winded after all.
They are a danger to you, mortal, not I. You saw how I fared against the Thane. How many times do I have to remind you? I am a prince.
Yes, I know. I didn't budge an inch. It's not as though you've given me a chance to forget it. He squared his shoulders and bared his teeth as if I'd just slapped him. I schooled myself, resisting the urge to reach for my ring. I just don't understand any of this. Fairy beasts, the conflict between your houses, why on earth the Wild Hunt's been after you for centuries if Hemlock knows she can't win? I suppose it's too much for my foolish mortal brain to take in. Rook relaxed. Annoyingly, he didn't register the sarcasm.
Hemlock is the huntsman, he replied. She obeys the call of the Winter Court, which ever seeks to spread its frost across the autumn lands.
The horn, I murmured. It commands her. She doesn't have a choice.
He nodded. For her, the hunt is everything. It is her only purpose. She will hunt until she dies, and at last must hunt no more.
Wind rustled through the canopy, and leaves pattered like rain across the clearing. I thought of Hemlock's ghastly face receding into the dark, the way she'd screamed at us to run. A shiver coursed through my body. The chill bite of the autumn air was finally catching up with me. Or was it? For then I wondered if I had shivered at all, because the trembling went on and on, heaving the ground beneath my feet. I staggered back, but there was no escape from the peculiar quickening that followed. Beginning at the point where Rook had spilled his blood, a tide of moss, starred with tiny, pale blue flowers no bigger than the tip of my little finger, surged forward, unfurling across the glade, foaming partway up the tree trunks, and my own legs. I yelped and pulled my boots free, sending clumps of moss flying as I gave my skirts a vigorous shake.
"Turn around,"
Rook said aloofly, watching me sidelong. For a moment, he'd adopted his old tone, as though we were friends in my parlor again, and it seemed a correction was in order. But turn I did, unable to help myself. The glade's trees were growing, stretching higher and higher, their branches spreading toward one another overhead. Where they met in the center, they laced together under the glittering night sky. Smaller saplings struggled up from the moss between the larger trees to seal the gaps, putting forth trembling new leaves already resplendent in autumn colors. All of this happened nearly noiselessly, with only a quiet creaking, groaning, and snapping of expanding wood to mark the change. It was as though I had watched the glade age a century in a matter of seconds. But no glade would age like this naturally. I stood in an open space in which the trees spread around and above me like a cathedral. Their branches were so tightly interwoven they resembled flying buttresses. No amount of craftsmanship could capture the majesty or wonder of this living antechamber. Looking straight up left me dizzy. Scarlet leaves drifted from the silent heights, passing through shafts of moonlight on their way down. I whirled around.
Your blood did this.
Rook stood watching me, a conflicting clamor of emotions in his eyes, fascination observing my human response, hope that I would find what he had created beautiful, and beneath that, sorrow, as raw as an open wound. Desperation flashed across his features. He struggled to compose himself, but couldn't. Finally, he turned on his heel and put his back to me with a dramatic billow of his coattails, drew his sword a few inches, and pretended to inspect the blade.
"You'll be safe here tonight,"
he said imperiously.
"The hunt won't be able to sniff us out in a Rowan glade, and even if Hemlock did chance upon this place by accident, no fairy beast, no fair one alive, could breach the magic I have just wrought."
The knowledge that he was only telling the bare, unembellished truth made the breath catch in my throat. He was arrogant, verging on insufferable, but God, the power he possessed. And here he was, as confused as a child by his own emotions, dragging me to trial over a painting. I couldn't believe that just that morning I thought I'd been in love with him. I shook my head. Incredible. 10,000, verging on 5 years old, I muttered to myself, testing the ground with my shoe.
What did you say?
Rook inquired frostily. Of course, fair folk had impeccable hearing. Nothing.
You did say something, but whatever it was, I'm certain it's beneath me.
He slid his sword back in with a snap.
Now lie down and get some rest. We begin again at sunrise.
Loath as I was to follow orders, I wouldn't do myself any good staying awake out of sheer stubbornness. I wandered around the glade until I found a lump in the moss I could put my back against, an engulfed tree stump, I thought, and curled up on my side facing Rook, who remained standing, facing away. I worked my ring back onto my finger, grateful to have at least some measure of protection, however small. But now I faced a different problem. I couldn't imagine how I was going to sleep. Emma and the twins probably hadn't noticed I was gone. They would in the morning, when they found my bed empty. What would Emma do? She'd given everything up to raise me. She'd promised on my father's deathbed to take care of me, and now I'd vanished in the night without a word. Unless I was very lucky and very clever, I had to remain honest about my odds, she'd never know what had happened to me. She'd wait for me forever. It seemed too cruel to bear. She had enchanted chickens guaranteed to each lay 6 eggs a week, I reminded myself. A cord of firewood magically appeared outside the house every other month. Another fair one delivered a fat goose once per fortnight, and oddly, due to an awkwardly worded agreement, a pile of exactly 57 walnuts materialized on the doorstep whenever a thrush sang in our oak tree. The twins would give her trouble, but she'd be all right. Wouldn't she? Several paces away, Rook had finally sat down. He sat elegantly with one arm propped up on his knee. Perhaps he knew I was watching and arranged himself in his handsomest pose accordingly. No, he thought I was asleep. Somehow I knew this to be the case, because he'd taken off his raven pin and was turning it over in his hands. Beyond him, the scarlet leaves continued sifting down through the moonlight, like rose petals illuminated by silvered, stained glass. Heartsick, I wondered if Emma would think I'd run off with him on purpose. Just hours ago, she had proven how well she knew me. If that was the case, she had to realize that no matter how wary I was of fair folk, I'd wanted to see Rook again more than anything else in the world. Maybe she'd be tortured forever by the possibility that her regretful words had encouraged me to run away. That I'd decided taking care of my family was a burden after all, and I'd abandoned her and the twins without bothering to say goodbye. It occurred to me, then, that my imagination was conjuring up increasingly unrealistic, maudlin scenarios, but wallowing neck deep in misery, I was powerless to stop it from happening. I thought of Emma taking too much of her tincture and collapsing. I thought of the twins going through my room, searching for any sign of where I'd gone, and finding Rook's drawings in my closet. A hot tear spilled over. I breathed through my mouth so Rook wouldn't hear me snuffling through my clogged nose. Eventually, I cried myself to exhaustion. My eyelashes drooped, and my vision blurred. I didn't remember falling asleep. When I woke up, everything was golden. The light caressing my face was golden, and the warmth was golden too. I felt like I was suspended in honey or amber. An autumn fragrance surrounded me, engulfed me, underlain with a wild, masculine, but not quite human smell that at once comforted me and settled like molten gold deep in my body, melted and poured into a crucible. Also, someone was combing my hair with his fingers. "Stop that!" I cried, bolting upright in alarm. Rook's coat fell from my shoulders, and I cast around until I found him behind me, wearing a self-satisfied smile. "What do you think you're doing?"
You have a few twigs left in your hair, he said, and reached toward me again.
I intercepted his hand with my own ring-wearing one, or at least tried to, because he was up like a shot before I managed it, glaring down at me.
Brooke, I said, trying to keep my voice steady. Before I get up, you have to promise to never touch me again without my permission.
I can touch whomever I please.
Have you ever stopped to think that just because you can do something doesn't mean you should?
His eyes narrowed.
No,
he said.
Well, this is one of those things.
I saw he didn't understand.
Among humans, it's considered polite, I added firmly.
A muscle jumped in his cheek, and his smile had faded.
Well, that doesn't sound in the least reasonable. What if you were being attacked, and I had to touch you to save your life, but I couldn't because I needed to request your permission first? Letting you die wouldn't be polite.
Fine, you can touch me in that case, but every other time you need to ask.
And why do you suppose I shall agree to your absurd mortal demands?
Peevishly, he snatched his coat from me and flung it back on himself without bothering to put his arms through the sleeves.
Because I can make your life miserable all the way to the Autumn Court, and you know it, I replied.
He stalked off across the glade. I got the feeling he needed to throw a tantrum before giving in. Sure enough, he soon returned with a stormy expression as the land changed all around him. The moss wilted brown, while thorny brambles erupted forth at his heels, grasping like fingers until they grew into an eldritch-looking tangle as high as my waist. I hadn't expected something quite so dramatic. Each thorn was as long as my finger, so sharp it glistened in the morning light. All my instincts shrieked at me to get up and run before they reached me. But that was the reaction Rook wanted, so I remained where I sat. The brambles writhed up all around my body, stretching crooked, twitching tendrils toward my clothes. Their thorns rattled together threateningly. I gave them a stern look. I knew a bluff when I saw one. Eventually, the brambles subsided, rather sulkily, and froze in place. Rook stood over me, encased within his bramble sea in a white-lipped state of high dudgeon, the final proof that I had won. Well? I asked.
I give my word that I will never touch you without your permission, except if I need to spare you from harm, he declared.
To his credit, he said it in a regal tone, with none of the petulance I expected. I sighed in relief.
Thank you, Rook.
You're welcome,
he said automatically, and frowned. This was like bowing. He had to respond to common courtesies whether he liked it or not. He recovered from the indignity by flinging his arm out theatrically. Two of the trees hiked up their roots and shuffled aside in a rather hasty, anxious way, as though they were a pair of bewildered matrons at whom he'd just hurled a billiard ball. Their bent trunks formed a new archway to the forest beyond.
Hurry along, then.
He swept toward the archway. A leftover root whisked solicitously out of his path.
Not only do I expect your little mortal legs will cover a disappointing amount of ground, we're already an hour delayed.
And whose fault is that? I thought.
However, as I crunched after him through the brambles, which disintegrated at a touch, my eyes fell on the neat pile of twigs and leaves he had taken from my hair. And despite myself, I smiled. We passed slender, white-barked birches, their yellow leaves shimmering and clattering like gold coins in the breeze. We passed stony brooks that wended between hillocks of moss, their water the color of milk with snowmelt. We passed ash trees that had shed half their foliage at once, pulled about their roots as a maiden might drop a shift. A stag and doe paused to watch us go by before they leapt away through the light-filled mist, casting their shadows against the air like a paper screen. The first unpleasant landmark we came to was a riven oak. It had been struck by lightning some time long ago, and sections of its trunk were charred black, the bark raised and glittering with beads of hardened sap. A few brown leaves still clung to its lower branches. Rook stopped to examine it. It looked out of place among the birches, watchful, malevolent.
A prickle of unease warned me to keep my distance. "Is that an entrance to a fairy path?" I asked, crunching along parallel to it. He spared me a glance and resumed walking.
"Yes, but we won't travel that way."
"You can't bring humans on them?"
"Oh, we certainly can. I merely find it inadvisable."
By that, he could mean anything. Perhaps the effort would be a drain on his power, or it would alert the wrong fair folk to our presence. He didn't seem open to further questions, and I didn't see how learning more might help my cause, so I didn't bother asking. Midday came and went. The sun shimmered through the leaves, freckling the ground in dappled patterns I would have found captivating if I'd been less preoccupied by my growing discomfort. My thighs and buttocks ached from last night's ride. I was dirty. I had mud all over my legs, and my skirts were stiff with burrs and dried horse sweat. I knew for a fact I smelled abominable. And God, I was starving. Meanwhile, Rook looked exactly as he had when he'd come to fetch me the night before. His boots shone, and not a single wrinkle marred his coat. The only thing disheveled was his hair, but that didn't count, since it always looked that way. We arrived at a long embankment descending into a ravine. Rook gracefully descended as I shuffled and skidded through the leaf litter until I finally considered the possibility of giving up and sliding down on my rear. While I frowned at the ground, Rook's hand extended into my field of vision. I didn't want his help, but it was better than making a fool of myself, so I placed my fingers in his. We seemed able to touch each other without a word, as long as I was the one who initiated it. His skin was cool, and his grip deceptively light. He helped me down the embankment and back up the hill on the other side as though I weighed no more than a feather. My stomach rumbled when we crested the top. To my dismay, it wasn't an ordinary rumble either. My innards summoned forth a booming growl, followed by a series of long, drawn-out squeals. Rook started back in alarm. Then, catching on to my condition, he gave me a knowing smile, which was interesting. Most fair folk didn't understand the concept of human hunger, not truly. And earlier, he'd spoken as if he'd already tried taking a human on the fairy paths himself. Had he traveled with a human before? Honestly, I should have suspected even earlier. He had human sorrow in his eyes, after all, and there was only one way he could have learned it. "I haven't eaten since supper yesterday," I said when my stomach finally, mercifully went quiet. "I don't think I can go on much longer without food."
"Only yesterday?"
"I assure you, most humans aren't accustomed to going a full day without a meal." He continued looking deeply skeptical, so I added in a steadfast tone, "I'm feeling quite poorly. In fact, I can't take another step. If I don't eat soon, I may die." His hair practically stood on end. I almost felt bad for him.
"Stay here,"
he said urgently, and vanished. The leaves he'd been standing on eddied as though stirred by a draft. I looked around. My stomach somersaulted, and my mouth went dry. The sparse, mossy undergrowth afforded a clear view into the far distance. I saw no tall figure, no raven winging through the forest. Rook truly did appear to be gone. "Run," I thought. But trying to urge my feet to move was like being 4 years old again, shifting at the foot of my mother's bed after a nightmare, unable to speak a word to wake her. The forest slumbered too. How easily would I draw its attention, and was I really prepared for that nightmare? As it turned out, I needn't have even bothered thinking about it. Something thumped into the leaves behind me, and I turned to find Rook standing over a dead hare.
"Go on,"
he said when I didn't move, glancing between me and the animal. I shuffled forward and picked it up by the scruff of its neck. It was still warm and watched me with its shiny black eyes. I said.
"Is there something wrong with it?"
His expression became guarded. I was ravenous. I was sore. I was terrified. And yet, looking at Rook, I imagined a cat proudly bringing its master dead chipmunks, only to watch the two-legged oaf lift these priceless gifts by the tail and fling them unceremoniously into the bushes. Before I knew it, I'd dissolved into laughter. Rook shifted, torn between uneasiness and anger.
What?
He demanded. I sank to my knees, the hair on my lap gulping in air.
Stop that!
Rook looked around, as if concerned someone might witness him mismanaging his human. I howled even louder.
Isabel, you simply must control yourself.
He might have traveled with humans, but he most assuredly hadn't dined with us.
Rook!
I half wailed his name.
I can't just eat a rabbit!
I don't see why not.
It needs to be cooked!
For an instant, before he slammed the door shut on his expression, horror and confusion gripped him.
You mean to say you can't eat anything at all without using craft on it first?
I took a shuddering breath, calming down, but knew I'd go off again at the slightest provocation.
We can eat fruit as it is, and most nuts and vegetables, but everything else, yes.
How can this be?
He said to himself quietly. That was all it took. I gave a strangled sob. He crouched and scrutinized my face, which I'm sure at that moment looked anything but attractive.
What do you require?
A fire to start with. Some branches to make a spit out of, I suppose. Or maybe we could cut it up and skewer it. I've never cooked a rabbit outdoors before.
I might as well have started reciting an incantation. Wood. I revised for him. Some kindling about this size, I spread my hands, and a long, thin, sturdy stick with a pointy end.
Very well.
He rose.
I will bring you your sticks.
Wait, I said, before he could vanish again. I held up the hair. He tensed.
Can you skin this for me? You know, remove the fur? And it needs to be in pieces, too. I can't do any of that without a knife.
How very mortal you are,
he said disdainfully, and seized the hair from my hand.
Oh, and take the insides out first, please, I added, undeterred.
He halted just as he was about to disappear, shoulders stiff.
Will that be all?
A devilish part of me wondered how far I could push him. If I pretended it was necessary for my craft, could I command him to stand on his head or turn in a circle three times while he prepared the hair? Only my empty stomach's increasingly urgent demands prevented me from having some fun at his expense. For now, I replied. Less than 20 minutes later, we sat in front of a badly smoking fire, which had seemed hopeless until Rook tired of watching me rub two twigs together and set the kindling ablaze with a flick of his long fingers. He cast impatient glances at the sun while I turned a haunch, at least I think that's what it was, fair folk weren't scrupulous butchers as it turned out, over the flames. Grease dripped from the meat, hissing when it struck the smoldering wood. My mouth watered, and I tried not to dwell on the likelihood that under better circumstances I would find the odor rank rather than appetizing. I'd never known rabbit to smell quite like this, but as long as I kept charring it by accident, at least it probably wouldn't make me sick. Waiting for me to finish, Rook gave his 7th dramatic sigh. I'd started counting. "You give it a try if you're so bored," I said, handing over the skewer. He took it between his thumb and forefinger. After examining the meat, turning it to and fro, he flippantly lowered it toward the fire. Instantly, a change came over him. At first, I thought he had spied something awful in the forest behind me, and I jerked around with my skin crawling. There was nothing there. Yet he still wore the same expression, his eyes wide and stricken, his features utterly still, as if he'd just received news of someone's death or was dying himself. It was terrible in a way I cannot describe. I've painted 1,000 faces and never seen such a look. What was happening? I scrambled for an answer until I realized. Craft. We could transmute substances as easily as we breathed, but for fair folk, such creation did not exist. It was so contrary to their nature, it had the power to destroy them. Astonishingly, even something as simple as roasting a hare over an open flame seemed to count as craft, according to whatever force governed his kind. No more than a second or two had elapsed before Rook's glamour began flaking away like old paint, revealing his true form, but not the way I remembered it. His skin was desiccated and gray, his eyes fading to lifelessness. It was as though I watched lights go out within him one by one, dimming with every heartbeat. And I knew that if I did nothing, in another moment he'd be gone. I would be free. I could escape, or at least try. But I thought of the forest cathedral, the scarlet leaves sifting down in silence. The look on his face when he'd transformed into a raven in my parlor. The smell of change on the wild wind, and the way he had let me turn his head, his eyes on mine full of sorrow. All those wonders crumbling to dust, without a trace of them left in this world. So I lunged across the fire and tore the stick from his hands. Seven. He cried out when the stick left his grasp, a sharp, haunting sound of anguish, pain, but also loss. Color flooded back into him, his glamour following behind, though he still slumped to the side and had to catch himself with a hand against the ground before he fell.
"Isabel,"
he croaked uncertainly, looking up at me. My voice came from far away, swept downstream by the blood rushing in my ears.
"It was craft. Cooking. When I offered it to you, I didn't know. I had no idea."
His attention fell to the stick I held, a piece of wood with a lump of rabbit flesh smoldering on the end. I shared his disbelief. Almost impossible that something so ordinary could harm him.
We should go.
He was so out of sorts he nearly sounded human. He staggered to his feet and turned first one way and then another, unable to get his bearings.
"We haven't covered nearly enough. Have you eaten? Are you still hungry?"
"I can eat as we walk," I said quietly, stunned to see him reduced to this. From Emma's instruction, I recognized the symptoms of shock.
"You aren't going to die?"
he asked. I shook my head. Toying with him didn't seem nearly as amusing now.
"Good."
His hand went to his sword, perhaps seeking out its reassuring solidity. He next patted his pockets with a disquieted air until he found the raven pin on his breast and squeezed it.
"In that case..."
He cut himself off and whipped around, every muscle in his body tensed. At first, I thought he'd gone mad. Then I heard it too, a high, unearthly sound in the distance, howling. "I suppose it was only a matter of time before the wild hunt caught up with us," I said reasonably, suddenly feeling strongly that someone ought to behave in a reasonable and reassuring way, even if that person, unfortunately, had to be me. "It sounds like we have a good head start, at least."
"No, it was not only a matter of time. We are deep in my domain, my realm. Hemlock should have not been able to track us this far so easily."
"Perhaps the difference is that I'm with you now. As you might have noticed, I do have a bit of a, smell."
He barely spared me a glance, passing up the ripe opportunity to criticize my mortality. The longer he remained rattled, the more apprehensive I became. He didn't see the wild hunt as a serious threat. So was it just his recent near-death experience making him act like this, or something more, something I didn't know about? Coming back to himself, he released his raven pin as though it had scalded him.
"We need to be out of the autumn lands before dusk."
And with that, he fixed on a direction and set off. I snatched up as much of the cooked meat as I could carry, sloshing after him through the ankle-deep leaves.
"Wait, out of the autumn lands? What do you mean? I thought we were traveling to the autumn court."
"We are, just not the same way we were before."
"May I ask where we're going, then?"
"To the place where Hemlock's power wanes, farthest from the winter court. It will be harder, perhaps impossible, for her to track us in the summerlands."
The landscape changed gradually. The sun sank behind the hills, casting long, straight shadows behind the trees and saturating everything in russet light. Thicker-trunked oaks, elms, and alders crowded out the slender birches and ashes. A melancholy air hung over this part of the forest. The leaves were brown, or a dull rust-red, and fungus mottled the roots and marched up the trunks, yellow and fleshy in character. Out of curiosity, I placed my hand on the bark next to one of these mushroom colonies, only for the bark to peel away in my hand. The exposed wood beneath was pale and spongy, and wood lice scampered away into its crevices. I dropped the bark, which burst rotten on the ground, and hurried to catch up with Rook several paces ahead. "We should be reaching the Summerland soon, shouldn't we?" I asked, just for conversation's sake. The quiet here bore down like a physical weight. I couldn't help but feel as though something might be listening, an impression that intensified the longer we remained silent.
"We are in the Summerlands. We have been for some time."
"But the trees..."
"Are not of autumn," Rook replied. "No, these trees are dying."
Tension narrowed his eyes and set his jaw.
"I have heard... whispers that in some places the Summerlands have gone amiss. I've never had occasion to see the blight with my own eyes. I confess, it's worse than I expected."
"Surely the forest can be healed. I watched you raise an entire glade with a few drops of your blood."
"Here only one person holds such power."
His gaze flicked to me, the warning in their amethyst depths clear as a length of exposed steel.
"And he uses his lifeblood as he sees fit."
The trees grew larger and farther apart. The knotted roots bulging across our path reminded me of diseased veins. Immense stones thrust up from the ground at intervals, standing higher than I was tall, draped in thick mantles of moss and blood-red ivy. The late sunlight produced one last burst of gold that sparkled through the failing leaves, and in this light, I saw a face staring out at me from the next stone we passed. I halted. My blood froze. It wasn't an actual face. It was carved into the rock. But such was its realism that my mind registered the being as a living thing before logic caught up with me. Speckled with moss and bearded with vines, his grave visage was both ancient and pensive, his closed eyes sunken into webs of wrinkles. A crown of interwoven antler tines rested upon his unforgiving brow. At that moment, I seemed to look upon an ailing king laid out on his deathbed, a sovereign whose cruel, mirthless conscience ruminated on all the wrongdoings of his long life without remorse. But no, I knew instantly my impression was wrong. This king did not know death. He slept, perhaps, but did not die. He never would. I looked around and found the same face on every stone. Without a shadow of a doubt, these engravings were craft. Humans hadn't been permitted in the forest for thousands of years. I couldn't imagine the age of them, and what might drive the people of that forgotten era to carve over and over again the terrible countenance of the Alder King. The Alder King. Drooping motionlessly since we'd arrived, the leaves rattled in a hot, stale breeze. The Alder King, my traitorous thoughts whispered again, naming the nameless fear clutching at me from all sides. The Alder King. Now that I'd started, it was impossible to stop.
Isabel.
Rook strode out of a thicket, pushing aside the branches of a buckthorn shrub. I hadn't noticed he'd gone anywhere. He went to grab my shoulder, but his hand froze a hair's breadth above my dress.
"We need to leave, quickly."
I didn't mean to. The thicket drew my gaze, and what I saw there silenced me. Beyond the wild buckthorn hedge lay a clearing with more of the carven stones arranged in a circle. At the center of the circle, a hill bulged from the ground. It was perhaps 15 feet long and half that wide, and its rounded back stood taller than the tops of the stones. A barrow mound. Rook had been talking about a different danger entirely. A flap and flutter of wings sounded in the stillness. A croak, and then another. I looked up. An entire flock of shiny-eyed ravens roosted in the trees above us, watching, waiting. A dozen ravens for death. What about a score? 100 more?
You thought his name, Rook said after a pause. You're thinking it even now.
I dragged my attention back to him. I knew dread gripped every inch of my expression. He didn't seem angry with me. His expression was neutral, a layer of ice under which fearsome currents raced unseen. I wished he'd looked angry. This was worse. It meant that whatever was about to happen was so awful he couldn't afford to waste time feeling anything at all.
Prepare to ride, he said, stepping back.
Just as it had when he transformed the night before, a wind gusted through the trees, carrying forth a whirlwind of leaves. I braced myself for his shape to shift as soon as it struck. But this time, the wind died as it approached, and the leaves wafted uselessly the last few feet, scattering around his boots. Rook scowled. He stood straighter, and soon another, stronger wind roared up from the depths of the forest, but it too petered out before it reached him. The barrow mound drew my gaze again and again. All those ancient stones, all of them facing inward, like wardens standing guard over a prisoner. For millennia they had watched it, unable to look away. But now the heat felt oppressive. A faint smell of putrefaction hung in the air. One of the ravens gave a single, grating call, harsh as a saw rasping against metal. "Why can't you change?" I asked, without ever taking my eyes from the mound. Rook dismissed his latest attempt at transformation with a flick of his hand, though a defiant glint shone in his eyes, and he looked none the worse for wear.
"This place won't allow me to. It appears we have stumbled upon the resting place of a barrow lord."
Well, that was that. I wasn't waiting around to introduce myself to something called a barrow lord, capitalized. I gathered up my skirts, preparing to run. Then something about the way he'd said, "appears," caught up with me. "Oh, God, this is the first time you've come across one, isn't it?"
"They are seldom encountered," he said grudgingly.
Noticing my stance, he added,
"No, do not flee. It is already awake beneath the earth. It knows we are here. It cannot be outrun, and would only overtake us with our backs turned. This time, we stand and fight."
His gaze flicked to me again.
"Or rather, I do, while you do your best to stay out of the way."
He'd dispatched a thane with a single sword thrust. He'd called destroying the wild hunt's hounds child's play. But that knowledge was cold comfort with an entire flock of ravens roosting over my head, and the fact that this time Rook had been willing to retreat without a word of complaint. "What is a barrow lord, exactly?" I asked.
"In this matter, you might prefer ignorance."
"Believe me, I never do."
"If you insist,"
he said, reluctant.
"Most fairy beasts rise with a single mortal's bones lending them life."
I nodded. I had known as much already.
"Barrow lords are aberrations, each one a mass of remains, entangled with one another in death. They are tormented creatures, enraged, at odds with themselves. We do not nurture their growth. They quicken on their own, in places where the mortals of ages past buried victims of war or plague."
As if hearing itself spoken about, the mound quivered. Soil shifted and tumbled to the ground. A grotesque sound emanated from within, the damp sucking of something moist coming apart deep below the earth. Whatever this thing was, it was bigger than a thane, bigger than all the hounds combined. Rook unsheathed his sword and strode toward the mound, projecting a casual ease and confidence that struck me as being as fake as his glamour. Whether he was wearing it for my benefit or his own, I couldn't guess. As soon as he reached the stone circle's outer edge, the mound heaved in earnest. It bulged first in one place and then another, like a larva attempting to split its cocoon. Carrion beetles poured from the earth in rivulets, along with some sort of dribbling fluid. The stench of wet decay struck me like a punch to the gut. Hopelessly, I doubled over and retched. One last straining swell, and the mound disgorged its contents. A lopsided form burst forth, slumping over Rook at twice his height, lumps of dirt cascading off its sides. No illusion softened this monstrosity. It had the correct number of appendages, in more or less the expected places, but that was all I could say in its favor. Its flesh was the skin of a decomposing log, riddled with disease and fungus. Its head, a hollow bark cave with two empty sockets from which a pair of mushroom clusters grew, wiggling about on long stalks with a life of their own. Right away, the stalks twisted simultaneously, pointing the mushroom's caps down at Rook. Eyes. Those were its eyes. Pressure built at the back of my skull. In the distance, or behind a closed door, voices argued. A little girl sobbed. Impatiently, someone scolded her. A man bellowed in wordless agony. The Barrow Lord gave a convulsive ripple, almost overbalancing itself. Its frame was bear-like, but its front legs, its arms, I found myself thinking, were overlong, and it struggled to maintain its drooping, upright stance. It was trying to make itself human again, I realized, in the only way it could. Rook's sword flashed, opening a slice along the beast's underbelly. Its putrid skin split without effort. He stepped back just in time to avoid the slippery cascade of fungus that spilled from the wound, halting one neat inch from the tips of his boots. The voices stopped. They all screamed in unison. The Barrow Lord's arm lashed out, scoring the statue in front of which Rook had stood a split second earlier, spraying chips of stone and moss. It slashed at him again and again, senseless and unpredictable in its maddened violence, forcing him to retreat beyond its reach. His back touched the hedge, and he began circling it, his steps easy, a cat circling a hound unafraid. It shambled after him, lunging clumsily over the standing stones. Rook was trying to draw it away from me, but as soon as I had that thought, the little girl's voice called out, strident, and the Barrow Lord paused. In a sudden, wet contraction, the mushrooms rolled backward to look at me instead. I stumbled back blindly. I heard the groan and crash of trees toppling, my gaze fixed only on the horror hurtling in my direction. It was so rotten, pieces of its body peeled away as it ran, dislodged by the concussive force of its stride. Rook appeared between us. His sword flashed once, twice. The arm the Barrow Lord had raised to cut me down exploded porously on the forest floor. Beetles swarmed in the cavity left behind. Missing a limb, its unbalanced weight dragged it backward, and it collapsed against a pair of the carven stones, skin rupturing, pushing the monuments aslant. For a moment, I thought Rook had won. The fall had left the beast in ruins. Mucus glistened, seeped from the wreckage of its hide. But already it struggled back upright, wet fungus-slimed roots slopping out of its stump to form a new arm. Its head weaved from side to side, dripping. The voices consulted one another in an agitated murmur. Rook adjusted his grip on his sword as he stalked back into the fray, crushing debris beneath his heels. Out flashed the blade. Chunks of wood flew. He could go on like this for days, chipping away at the monster without rest. If it hadn't been for the need to keep me alive, I suspected the Barrow Lord wouldn't have posed much of a threat to him at all. Something grabbed my ankle. I looked down. A human skeleton, held together with vegetable sinew, had clawed free from the Barrow Lord's severed limb. Shuddering nightmarishly, it flung its other hand up to seize my skirt in its bony fingers. Tumorous mushrooms bulged between its ribs, forced its jaw ajar. It clutched at me, dragging itself higher, grip by hard-won grip. Closer than all the other voices, a woman sobbed and pleaded. "I can't help you," I whispered, turned inside out and shaken empty by horror. "I can't." Rook was there. He seized the corpse by its skull and wrenched it off me, crushing the brown, age-brittled bone like an eggshell. Then he looked over his shoulder. Without hesitation, he seized me by the shoulders and pushed me aside. I landed in the bushes, the breath dashed from my lungs, just in time to see the Barrow Lord swat him. Rook slammed against a tree trunk several yards away and slumped to the ground, his sword skittering across the clearing. Oh, God. The Barrow Lord only had eyes for me now. It lumbered forward until I lay in the fetid darkness of its shadow. Ravens launched themselves, shrieking from the trees, to claw and peck at its back, flap wings in its face, but their calls soon turned to shrill squawks of desperation as their feathers stuck to the Barrow Lord's hide. Skeletal hands surfaced, clutching at them greedily, pulling them aside. The bird struggled and thrashed, but soon all that remained was a beak here, a wing there, protruding at random from the monster's rancid flesh. Some of them kept twitching. The Barrow Lord lowered its head to my level. Its head alone was the size of a log, the round mouth hollow broad enough for a person to crawl into. The mushrooms twisted and turned. A hot gust blew out, and then another. Surely I was too small, too weak to pose this creature any danger. The voices whispered among themselves. The little girl giggled. A ragged wail tore from my chest, and I sank my fingers into its spongy face. This gave me enough purchase to haul myself up and seize one of its eye clusters with my other hand, the one wearing the iron ring. Instantly, the mushrooms wilted. They turned gray and brittle, shriveling in my grasp. All the voices groaned in unison from that faraway room I'd begun to think of as hell, and the Barrow Lord took a step back, dragging my legs across the ground. I gave the eye stalks one last squeeze, feeling them crumble away. I only needed to buy myself another second, because out of the corner of my eye, I saw Rook getting up. He had one hand inside his coat, holding his chest, and the look on his face was terrifying to behold, contorted with pain and fury. His steps weaved. I wondered if he'd make it. He did. I let go and tumbled to the ground as he staggered up to the Barrow Lord's face, pulled the bloody hand from his coat, and thrust it straight into the monster's mouth. First, there came a cracking sound, wood splintering and snapping. The Barrow Lord's body convulsed and canted stiffly to one side. Then thorny branches, as thick around as my torso, burst from every inch of its flesh, skewering it 100 times over, pinning it in place like a grisly statue. I wasn't sure if it was dead. I'm not sure that it even mattered. One last branch pushed slowly out of its remaining eye, and yellow leaves unfolded inches from my nose. "Brook," I breathed. "You did it! You..." But a thump interrupted me. I pushed the leaves aside to find Rook collapsed, unconscious, with his glamour bleeding away. Eight. The first thing I noticed upon dropping to my knees next to him was that his clothes were torn and dirty from the battle and wrinkled by travel. I hadn't gotten a good look at them when he'd lost his glamour earlier that afternoon, and the change was shocking. In an instant, he'd gone from prince to vagabond. Somehow it hadn't occurred to me that he might use his glamour to alter his clothing's appearance, too. Most astonishing of all, until now, the enormous tear across his coat front, where the Barrow Lord had struck him, had been completely invisible to my eyes.
"How much magic do you waste on vanity? For heaven's sake, you could barely stand!"
My hands shook as I slipped off my ring, put it away, and undid the buttons down his front.
"It wasn't as though the Barrow Lord and I cared how you looked, you know."
I spread his coat open, and his head lolled to the side. His mouth was slightly parted. I had decided not to look too closely at the sharp teeth showing behind his lips, but as it turned out, I needn't have even bothered thinking about it, because the wound on his chest demanded all my attention and then some. I didn't have a basis for comparison, but I could make an educated guess that with his glamour on, his chest wouldn't look so gaunt, each of his ribs showing clearly through his skin. I just wished I couldn't see that much of his ribs. Not all of the white showing amid the blood belonged to his torn-up shirt. The wound was long and gruesome, running from his collarbone to the left side, all the way down over his ribs to the right. A human with that injury would have been dying of blood loss. Thankfully, he didn't seem to be bleeding out, but I'd have felt a great deal more optimistic about the situation if he had been conscious, smugly informing me that the bone-deep gash in his chest was only a flesh wound. "Rook," I said, patting his cheek and trying not to cringe. His jutting bones and hollow face conjured an echo of the skeleton crawling up my legs. "You're a prince, remember? Wake up and infuriate me, please." He turned his face toward my hand and moaned. "You'll have to try a little harder than that." I balled up some of his coat and pressed it against his chest. Then, remembering the night before, I took his right wrist and turned his hand palm up. So he'd used his glamour to hide the cut after all. Yet his hand was healing quickly. If I hadn't known otherwise, I would have believed the wound a week old or more. I started when I realized his eyes were slitted open. He was watching me.
"You're still here,"
he murmured, half delirious. Quickly, I set his hand back down. "Where else would I be?"
"Running."
If you hadn't noticed, this forest is full of things that want to kill me. Even their dismembered limbs want to kill me. As loath as I am to admit it, I'm better off taking my chances with you.
"Perhaps,"
he said. He tried to move, and his eyes rolled back in his head. "Don't be cryptic. What do I need to do to get us out of here? Rook?" I patted his cheek again.
"Help me stand. No, fetch my sword first, and then..."
I got up and cast about for his sword. The clearing had transformed in just the short time I'd been kneeling. The Barrow Lord's petrified remains were almost unrecognizable now, engulfed by a giant tree still unfurling new branchlets. Golden leaves rained down steadily, depositing a bright accumulation of foliage through which I shuffled on my quest to find Rook's weapon. Finally, I found it, only because its hilt poked out of the leaves. When I came back, the falling leaves had nearly covered him. I ran the last few steps, stumbling once over a concealed root on the way, and brushed him off while he watched me in silence. Too weak, I supposed, to remark upon the strangeness of my behavior. Even I couldn't say for certain why the sight of him vanishing into the forest floor alarmed me so, only that there was something funereal about it, something final, as if the earth were swallowing him up. When I was done, he tried to take the sword from my hands, but there was no strength in his grip. I had to help him guide it back into its sheath. A question ached on the back of my tongue, embedded like a fishhook, tugging forth the awful words. "Are you dying?" I blurted out in an odd tone of voice, almost an accusation. He frowned.
"Is that what you want?"
"No!" My vehemence seemed to surprise him, so much so that I felt I had to defend my answer. "If I wanted you dead, why would I have taken the stick from you this afternoon?"
"You gave it to me first."
"Not knowing what would happen, nor did you." I struggled for words. "What you're doing to me, it isn't right. Of course I don't want to be your captive, but there's a difference between that and wanting you dead." Did he understand that? His wandering gaze suggested otherwise. Did human feelings matter to him at all? "Perhaps you ought to know," I added harshly, "because it's over and done with now, that 2 days ago I thought I was in love with you." His eyes sharpened, striving through the haze of pain to focus on my face. Then he looked aside and let his arm flop out on the ground, a futile movement, as though he were reaching for something just beyond his grasp. He looked so inhuman. It didn't satisfy me to have gotten a reaction out of him at last. I just felt cold.
"Help me to my feet."
It was an effort for him to speak. The air wheezed in and out of his lungs, a quiet gasp with every inhale. I wondered if one of his ribs had broken and punctured a lung, a danger Emma had explained to me one night with a tincture in her hand, and if so, whether anything could be done about it. But Rook spoke first, saying,
"We must return to the Autumn Lands. I cannot heal myself here. There is something wrong with this place, a corruption I cannot explain."
He paused for breath.
"With luck, some good will have come out of it all the same, and the hunt will have been thrown off our trail."
I gathered his slung-out arm over my shoulder and did my best to lift him. He managed to rise, but only by leaning on me heavily, and when his weight shifted, he made an anguished sound, almost a sob, that sent a keen dart of sympathy lancing through my own chest. "Shouldn't you call for other fair folk?" He sucked in a breath and replied in a rasping, gusty voice,
"No.